In the Akwesasne community itself, which put out Akwesasne notes, the Indians had always insisted their territory was separate, not to be invaded by the white man's law. One day, New York State Police gave 3 traffic tickets to a Mohawk Indian truck driver, and a council of Indians met with a police lieutenant. At first, he insisted that he had to follow orders and give out tickets, even in Akwesasne territory, although he obviously was trying to be reasonable. He finally agreed that they would not arrest an Indian in the territory or even outside of it without first having a meeting with the Mohawk Council. The lieutenant then sat down and lit a cigar. Indian Chief Jokiso, a distinguished-looking man with long hair, rose and addressed the lieutenant with a serious voice. "There is one more thing before you go," he said, looking straight at the lieutenant. "I want to know," he said slowly, "if you've got an extra cigar." The meeting ended in laughter. Akwesasne Notes continued to publish. On its poetry page, late autumn 1976, appeared poems reflecting the spirit of the times. As Abernathy wrote, "I am grass growing and the shearer of grass. I am the willow and the splitter of laths, weaver and the thing woven, marriage of willow and grass. I am frost on the land and the land's life, breath and beast and the sharp rock underfoot. In me the mountain lives and the owl strikes, and I in them. I am the sun's twin, mover of blood and the blood lost. I am the deer and the deer's death. I am the burr in your conscience. Acknowledge me." And this from Buffy St. Marie. "You think I have visions because I am an Indian. I have visions because there are visions to be seen." In the 60s and 70s, it was not just a women's movement, a prisoners' movement, an Indian movement. There was general revolt against oppressive, artificial, previously unquestioned ways of living. It touched every aspect of personal life: childbirth, childhood, love, sex, marriage, dress, music, art, sports, language, food, housing, religion, literature, death, schools. The new temper, the new behavior, shocked many Americans. It created tensions. Sometimes it was seen as a generation gap, the younger generation moving far away from the older one in its way of life. But it seemed after a while to be not so much a matter of age. Some young people remained straight, while some middle-aged people were changing their ways, and old people were beginning to behave in ways that astounded others. Sexual behavior went through startling changes. Premarital sex was no longer a matter of silence. Men and women lived together outside of marriage and struggled for words to describe the other person when introduced. "I want you to meet my friend." Married couples candidly spoke of their affairs, and books appeared discussing open marriage. Masturbation could be talked about openly, even approvingly. Homosexuality was no longer concealed. Gay men and gay women, lesbians, organized to combat discrimination against them, to give themselves a sense of community, to overcome shame and isolation. All this was reflected in the literature and in the mass media. Court decisions overruled the local banning of books that were erotic or even pornographic. A new literature appeared, The Joy of Sex and others, to teach men and women how sexual fulfillment could be attained. The movies now did not hesitate to show nudity, although the motion picture industry, wanting to preserve principle as well as profit, set up a classification system, R for restricted, X for prohibited to children. The language of sex became more common both in literature and in ordinary conversation. All this was connected with new living arrangements. Especially among young people, communal living arrangements flourished. A few were truly communes, that is, based on the sharing of money and decisions, creating a community of intimacy, affection, trust. Most were practical arrangements for sharing the rent, with varying degrees of friendship and intimate association among the participants. It was no longer unusual for men and women to be roommates, in groups of 2 or 3 or larger, and without sexual relations, as practical, unself-conscious arrangements. The most important thing about dress in the cultural change of the 60s was the greater informality. For women, it was a continuation of the historic feminist movement's insistence on discarding of feminine, hampering clothes. Many women stopped wearing bras. The restrictive girdle, almost a uniform of the 40s and 50s, became rare. Young men and women dressed more nearly alike, in jeans and discarded army uniforms. Men stopped wearing neckties. Women of all ages wore pants more often, unspoken homage to Amelia Bloomer. There was a new popular music of protest. Pete Seeger had been singing protest songs since the 40s, but now he came into his own. His audience is much larger. Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, singing not only protest songs, but songs reflecting the new abandon, the new culture, became popular idols. A middle-aged woman on the West Coast, Malvina Reynolds, wrote and sang songs that fit her socialist thinking and her libertarian spirit, as well as her critique of the modern commercial culture. Everybody now, she sang, lived in little boxes, and they all came out just the same. Bob Dylan was a phenomenon unto himself. Powerful songs of protest, personal songs of freedom and self-expression. In an angry song, Masters of War, he hopes that one day they will die and he will follow their casket in the pale afternoon. A hard rain's a-gonna fall recounts the terrible stories of the last decades of starvation and war and tears and dead ponies and poisoned waters and damp, dirty prisons. It's a hard rain's a-gonna fall. Dylan sang a bitter anti-war song, With God on Our Side, and one about the killer of the black activist Medgar Evers, only a pawn in their game. He offered a challenge to the old, hope to the new, for the times they are a-changin'. The Catholic upsurge against the war was part of a general revolt inside the Catholic Church, which had for so long been a bulwark of conservatism, tied to racism, jingoism, war. Priests and nuns resigned from the church, opened their lives to sex, got married and had children, sometimes without bothering to leave the church officially. True, there was still enormous popularity for the old-time religious revivalists, and Billy Graham commanded the obedience of millions, but now there were small, swift currents against the mainstream. There was a new suspicion of big business, of profiteering as the motive for ruining the environment. There was a re-examination of the death industry of money-making funerals and profitable tombstones, as in Jessica Mitford's The American Way of Death. With the loss of faith in big powers, business, government, religion, there arose a stronger belief in self, whether individual or collective. The experts in all fields were now looked at skeptically. The belief grew that people could figure out for themselves what to eat, how to live their lives, how to be healthy. There was suspicion of the medical industry and campaigns against chemical preservatives, valueless foods, advertising. By now, the scientific evidence of the evils of smoking, cancer, heart disease, was so powerful that the government barred advertising of cigarettes on television and in newspapers. Traditional education began to be re-examined. The schools had taught whole generations the value of patriotism, of obeying authority, and had perpetuated ignorance, even contempt for people of other nations, races, Native Americans, women. Not just the content of education was challenged, but the style, the formality, the bureaucracy, the insistence on subordination to authority. This made only a small dent in the formidable national system of Orthodox education, but it was reflected in a new generation of teachers all over the country and a new literature to sustain them. Jonathan Kozel, Death at an Early Age, George Denison, The Lives of Children, Ivan Illich, Deschooling Society. Never in American history had more movements for change been concentrated in so short a span of years. But the system, in the course of two centuries, had learned a good deal about the control of people. In the mid-70s, it went to work.